September 13th marked the 20th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act. This landmark piece of federal legislation reframed domestic violence as a crime, whereas in the past it had been treated as a personal matter left to families or loved ones to sort out. So perhaps it's a cruel irony that around the same time, a video showing a football player hitting his then-fiancée was released, sparking a new conversation about whether domestic violence is a public or private issue. Do requests for privacy need to be respected, or do onlookers have a responsibility toward involvement? Who decides what's best for victims? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on today's Central Standard, after this news.
New at 11, Ravens head coach John Harbaugh responds to the stunning and graphic video showing his star running back assaulting his then fiance.
Many had asked what happened inside of the elevator, what led to a two-game suspension for Ravens running back Ray Rice. Well, now we know.
Many people are asking how she could stay with him.
Janae Palmer Rice is letting her voice be heard via her Instagram account, and here's what she posted. To take something away from the man that I love, that he has worked his blank off for all of his life just to gain ratings is horrific. This is our life. What don't you all get?
Ever since the Ray Rice scandal broke, the often private pain of domestic violence has been all over the news, generating public discussion of all kinds. Janae Rice, the woman being hit by her husband on a now public surveillance video, has criticized the media for making her relive a traumatic moment and for judging her relationship based on that moment. Plenty of people have since expressed disbelief at her decision to stay in that relationship. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning on Central Standard, we're going to move beyond the sensational headlines in an attempt to understand the complex realities facing victims of domestic violence. To help with that is Bruce Lease, a regular psychology expert here on Central Standard. He's a professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
And we're also joined this morning by Scott Mason of the Rose Brooks Center, a domestic violence shelter in Kansas City. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning.
So just a quick note before we proceed. Today's show might trigger difficult emotions and memories for some listeners. I'm going to turn first to Bruce Lease. Bruce, how do you define domestic violence?
Well, it's a pretty broad phenomenon. It ranges from, just like abuse generally, it ranges from psychological to physical and even to sexual violence, most commonly perpetrated against women. As many as 95% of the people who are victims are
95%.
Yeah, and that's controversial. Some people believe that men are way more than 5% likely victims, but the likelihood of a man going to the police saying that he was abused by a woman is pretty small. So it's hard to
maybe our knowledge of those victims is lacking.
Exactly. That's right.
What are some of the main psychological dynamics at play in domestic violence scenarios?
Well, the most important dynamic, and this surprises a lot of people, the most important psychological dynamic is that of dependency. People stay in violent relationships because they feel dependent on the other person. It may be an emotional dependence. It may be a financial dependence. But interestingly, even perpetrators, those who are violent towards others, tend to be extremely dependent on the person that they are violent towards. And it's often, it can take the form of jealousy and wanting to possess somebody, that kind of dependency. It can be some kind of dependency for the purpose of ego or a whole lot of things. But it's really valuable to think about those who violate others, those who are violent towards other people that they claim to love. It's valuable to think of them as dependent, emotionally dependent on those people. And the research clearly supports that notion.
Why is that helpful?
It's helpful because in treating people who are domestically violent, it's important for them to understand that that's what's operating. It certainly is important for those who are victims of domestic violence to understand that their partners are pretty needy. And even though afterwards they say, I'm so sorry, I won't do it again, even though they say that because they're really needy. So everything that a perpetrator does should be understood through that lens, including by the victim who has to decide what they're going to do about this person that they live with and love, or they don't live with and they love.
Can mental illness play a role in how these things escalate?
It can play a major role. Mental illness can. There's been really good research on the kinds of, and I'll say men here, even though it would include women. The research's been on men. There's been really good research on the types of batterers that are out there, and people who would only hit someone in their family don't tend to be mentally ill if they are, and especially if it has to do with alcohol. So there are people who actually are not mentally ill. They're not sociopaths. They're not narcissists. They're not any of the mental illnesses. But they'll drink. They'll get in a fight with their partner, and they'll swing. They'll push. They'll shove. They'll be verbally abusive. So those are what they call family-only batterers. And then there are the people that have mental illnesses. They fall into other categories. One of them, actually, we did a show here on people with borderline personality. And men with borderline personality, especially if they are depressed, are at high risk for trying to control their partner with physical violence. Also, people who could be labeled as sociopaths, they are generally violent, aggressive people who would get in bar fights or who would start a fight with a stranger. And those people are also mentally ill, and those people are very dangerous. They're more likely to strike out for a wide range of reasons, whether it's control or jealousy, whereas the others are milder. And then the fourth category is just mildly or slightly depressed or angry people that also have like mild mental illness.
So these are diagnoses that obviously we could spend a lot of time trying to flesh out what all of these mean exactly. And it would be important for people to not just toss these terms around cavalierly, but these are diagnoses that lend themselves to.
Absolutely. Especially people who are borderline. Who have wild mood shifts, that have problems with anger, who don't regulate their emotions very well, who feel tremendously insecure. They are at very high risk. And then people who are sociopaths, antisocial people that believe that they won't let anything get in the way of what they want. So they are at very high risk.
And Scott Mason of the Rosebrook Center, does this stuff sound familiar to you?
It absolutely does. You know, I think one thing that we definitely do in our line of work, especially when we're working with victims of domestic violence, is we make sure that when we do our education, when we're speaking with them, that we're really careful with throwing around the mental illness piece of it, because it almost borderlines on the excusing the behavior. And when we look at the Janae and Ray Rice, you know, so many questions are still being asked as to why she stays and why she's in that relationship and why she chose to marry him. And what you don't see is, you know, what is underneath that relationship outside of the violence, you know, the mutual love and the mutual respect and all of that. But it absolutely sounds familiar when you talk about the low self-esteem or how an abuser needs their partner just as much as the victim needs their abusive partner. And, you know, we hear the borderline diagnosis as well. We hear a lot of that information, but you have to really be careful not to excuse the behavior. And, you know, and part of that is because an abuser chooses to abuse, and who they choose to abuse is their partner. They don't choose to abuse their brother, who they got in a fight with, or their boss, who they're mad at. They make a conscious choice to choose their partner. It all sounds very familiar, but we really have to be careful when we do education not to throw around those mental illness diagnoses.
Scott, I'm really glad to hear you say that. You know, these journal articles I read are really nerdy. They have lots of statistics and quantitative analyses and all of that. And for the first time ever, I saw a journal article in a science journal end with that statement. None of this is meant to excuse the batterer. A mental illness is not an excuse. So absolutely, even in the scientific literature, they recognize the importance of saying that. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Bruce, you mentioned earlier the dynamic of dependence and that, in fact, abusers and perpetrators of violence are often feel quite dependent on the person they abuse. Do you think that contributes to also something that might I don't know, create excuses. Like, you hear a sort of a protective impulse on the part of a victim at
times. Oh, yeah. I just love you so much. I wouldn't want to lose you. I'm sure people who are listening who have experienced domestic abuse have had the experience of having a partner first batter them and then cry, you know, like infants cry, sob because they say, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I don't know that they are really sorry. Perhaps they're just afraid that they're about to lose the person that they're so dependent upon. And it's a terrible, vicious cycle between battering and guilt and battering and guilt. But the guilt doesn't fix the batterer. They just often just keep going.
Talk to me about the process of disengagement. How does a person extricate him or herself from a violent situation at home? From the outside looking in, leaving might seem like an action that takes place in a moment, like you just walk out the door. But I suspect it's more of a process. Bruce, I want you to start on this, and then I'd like Scott to pick up.
Sure. You talked about disengagement. There's research on all of the things that could trigger a perpetrator, a batterer. Things like viewing their partners disrespecting them or threatening to leave or even nagging. So there are all these triggers that batterers get triggered by that cause them – I shouldn't say cause them. They cause themselves to batter. But these are triggers that set them off. And the first thing a person who's been battered can do is to know when anything happens that could be a trigger – to get out of there, to de-escalate by, you know, getting away, by not engaging, by realizing that their own distress often is what the other person wants to see. And so by removing yourself quickly and not letting it escalate, it is a natural process for somebody who has a very angry person in front of them. It's very natural to respond emotionally. And oftentimes, that's the worst thing you can do. Unfortunately, not responding triggers some people to become more violent. So it's very difficult, but it's a matter of getting away and not letting it escalate.
Scott, what are your thoughts about the process of getting yourself removed enough from the situation to leave?
Yeah, and first of all, thank you for saying it's not a single moment. It's a process, and that's one thing that we definitely want to educate on. And we do a lot of safety planning with the women that we see. And that's whether that's in the community, in the hospitals that we serve, or in our shelter. But definitely the safety planning piece can be an extensive process, and it's so different for everybody. But absolutely, it's those, how do you keep yourself safe in the relationship that you're in until you're ready to leave that relationship? And that's everything from getting your finances in order, disclosing to family and friends that you trust, disclosing to a coworker, knowing exactly what documents you need. It's such an extensive and sometimes overwhelming process for women that are trying to leave an abusive relationship, because there's also the complexities of shared children. It can be an extensive process, but it's such an important process when you're trying to leave safely.
I hear you saying that a lot of what is required to leave is actually practical planning, and not that there's the emotional piece of it, and there's understanding how to be safe before you can leave to the extent that that's possible. But there's also, a lot of planning.
Yeah, there's a lot of planning. And I'm glad that you said the emotional piece. Emotional safety planning is such an important part of their safety planning process.
And what is emotional safety planning?
Meaning that when you're in those abusive relationships and you know that you're going to be put down, you know they're going to tell you that you can't do it on your own, how to emotionally prepare yourself for that so that you can have the strength to leave beyond the practicality of it, from finding a support system, which a lot of women don't have. So the emotional and self-talk, even self-talk, we tell our victims and the women that we work with to tell yourselves that you can do it. You have the strength to do it. You have the ability to do it.
From a logistical standpoint, people are already in these conversations with you before they've left. How does that work? The decision to seek help being, I guess I hadn't totally imagined it being separate from the decision to leave.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, we have so many community partners that we interact with them outside of them calling a hotline and us being introduced to them. So we're in the hospitals in Kansas City. and we're in the police departments. So we interact with them a lot. Every victim that, or every woman or man that comes into a hospital and the hospitals that we serve, they're screened for domestic violence. So we interact with them that way. And they're not even anywhere near ready to leave that relationship because a lot of times it's the first time that they've ever disclosed that they're in an abusive relationship. And so that's a longer process. And then the police also do a lethality assessment. So every time they go on a domestic violence or an assault call, they ask the victims 13 questions and they determine their lethality, the likelihood of them being killed by their abuser.
There's so much at stake in this. I mean, getting that wrong could be horrible.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we train our law enforcement a lot on how to interpret those answers that those women give and sometimes men. But it has done an amazing job of bringing us women that truly, truly need our help. Since 2009, it's been an amazing program for us.
I want to talk more later in the show about the role of the law and law enforcement in dealing with these situations. But right now, the Rice scandal has triggered a truly overwhelming response on Twitter, where people have been using the hashtags why I stayed and why I left, and even now why I helped, or how I helped, excuse me, to tell their own stories of abuse. The why I stayed stories often point to economic and practical considerations or the fear of judgment from outsiders looking in as motivations keeping people in violent relationships. What's been your response to that?
Our response is shame is such a huge barrier for women to leave or to even tell you that they're in an abusive relationship. So that one resonates with us very, very clearly. And it's often the reason why there's victim blaming, because a woman will share a piece of her story, then it's met with disbelief or there's shame, and so she'll change her story. It's such a huge barrier for women. And so our response is just provide the education that we possibly can about victim blaming and to make sure that we don't do that for even our friends and family. Because, you know, what we forget is that domestic abuse is a family problem. It's usually between intimate partners, which means you or I possibly have it in our families, right? So it's victim blaming is a huge part of that.
Can you flesh out what you mean by victim blaming just a little bit?
Victim blaming is to insinuate that the victim had a role in the abuse. And it's a way for us to rationalize why it happened in the first place. As if to suggest that the abuse was equally shared between the two. And it can be as simple as I disclose to you that I'm in an abusive relationship and you say you are crazy for staying in that relationship. You should leave that relationship. And just a statement like that is victim blaming. And it will stop me from ever disclosing to you again. So even simple statements like that.
Bruce, what have been your thoughts watching all of this unfold and hearing these kinds of discussions?
Well, I've been really impressed with the kind of the evolution of the notion of empowerment. For a very long time, empowerment was just a buzzword. But now I think it's better understood, as Scott was saying, that empowerment is gradually, iteratively helping people to understand that they can protect themselves, that they can be safe, that they can, if they're well organized, when they're well organized, get out of the situation, that they won't be blamed. So empowerment, my thoughts about it are that empowerment is important, and there are certain components to empowerment that are important.
Bruce, Scott, can you stick with us through the break?
Absolutely.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will return to this conversation shortly. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning's Central Standard is a conversation about domestic violence in light of the public outcry the NFL scandal has sparked. We're gaining a deeper understanding of the victim's experience from psychologist Bruce Leese and Scott Mason of the Rosebrook Center. Welcome back, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
And thanks again for being here, Scott.
Thank you.
So, Bruce, before the break, you were just talking about empowerment. Can you explain in a little bit more depth what you mean by that in the context of domestic violence?
Yeah. When the term empowerment originally began to be used under these circumstances, you know, it sounded so strong and it had the word power in it. And it, you know, it was an exciting notion that we could get people empowered and they would do something. But it wasn't really well defined. And as time goes on and we define it more and more carefully, it really makes a lot of sense. Technically, I hate to turn a topic this emotional into something so technical, but technically, empowerment occurs when people shift from believing that they're helpless to starting to have some goals that they that they're helped to believe in, goals for themselves, goals for their lives, goals for their children who've been watching them be abused. So that goal setting is step one, and then developing some skills to achieve the goal is step two. This is all stuff I know Rose Brooks does for the women who come to them. So developing those skills, but with those skills also comes a sense of self-confidence, or with what they call self-efficacy, where the battered person starts to think, I can do this, and it's just a little tiny flicker at that moment in time. And as they get community support, that flicker grows into a full flame and they think, you know, I really can do this. And they start turning to community resources that help them, like Rose Brooks. And when they see that there's an impact on their own lives, on their children's lives, by doing good for themselves, when they see that impact, then they're even more confident. They've done, again, so much of what I do is research-based. They've done great research where they show that women who say that they feel empowered are less likely to develop PTSD. They are more likely to use the legal system after the first time they've used it. When the legal system reinforces their power to do something to take care of themselves, they're more likely to return to the legal system. If they feel disempowered because they have been treated badly or disregarded, then they're less likely. So this empowerment thing is really important and really good.
Scott Mason of Rose Brooks Center, talk to me about the women you encounter in your work. At what point along the violence timeline do you typically come to know them?
It varies every single time. The point of it could be right there when they're at the other end of law enforcement, and so they've just been beaten by their partner, so they may be speaking to us in a very traumatic time. It could be in the hospital in the ER waiting room where it's also very traumatic. Or it could be that they come in for a routine doctor's visit and they happen to disclose, and it's been happening for years and years. So it varies. And so we have to really be confident in how to work with them on each stage of their process.
And Scott, the common wisdom is that victims just need to leave, period. What are some of the factors that complicate that scenario in real life?
You know, and our job is to remove barriers, and there are many, many barriers to leaving. And that could be everything from the complexity of the emotional attachment of the relationship to the financial issues to child care to those types of issues. And, you know, and the court system, everything is just so overwhelming for these victims who are trying to leave their relationship, being documented or undocumented. So the complexities of it, we make sure that we work with them at every stage to make sure that we remove as many barriers as possible.
Do all domestic violence scenarios look alike? It's an easy pitfall to generalize. But what are some of the nuances and some of the, I don't know, the distinctions you might make?
You know, when we think about domestic abuse relationships, there's not an equality, but that's very difficult to see from the outside. So those red flags can be anything from the isolation that the victim has from their friends and family. And some of that happens so slowly over time. But some of the nuances is the isolation from friends and family. So their support system, the putting them down in front of friends and family, you know, those subtle ways that we put somebody down or always are sarcastic
or their buttons to push things
absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely. Yep.
What do you think are some of the biggest misunderstandings about domestic violence, especially when it comes to people who haven't experienced it themselves and don't have professional knowledge of the dynamics at play?
I think one of the things that we need to remember is that when we think of those relationships, they can be extremely dangerous. And for somebody to leave an abusive relationship is a very dangerous time for them.
What's dangerous about leaving?
Because the abuser loses control. So once the abuser believes that he or she is losing control, it becomes a very dangerous time for them and their children.
And Bruce, I'd like you to weigh in on this.
Which part?
Well, first of all, what you think it is that maybe people out there don't generally know or understand about particularly the victim's experience?
Nobody particularly likes to be around people who are suffering. First of all, people don't like to be around people who are suffering. And so they will move away from that person emotionally. And so there's a lot they don't know. They detach, which reinforces the secrecy that Scott was talking about that occurs because they're ashamed. So I would say that there's so much they don't understand. They don't understand the process of they may not even understand fear, the tremendous fear that a woman feels for her life, for her children if she leaves. So, I talk a lot about empathy. Empathy is not sympathy. Empathy is understanding what another person's life experiences, their thoughts, their feelings. So I would say there's often a complete lack of empathy for people who are abused and battered because people pull away instead of asking the important questions.
That's a really sad and interesting observation we like to think that we move closer to people who need us, especially people in our lives in their greatest times of need. But you're saying that that's not typically what happens.
Oh, so often you'll hear people say, I don't want to hang around him. He's a downer or she's a downer. You know, all he or she talks about is not liking their spouse or whatever. And that kind of distancing makes somebody who might have otherwise been a good resource no resource at all.
And
people
so that talking about something that's difficult could be building up toward a disclosure or asking for help or something like that.
Well, let's look at it really simply. Let's look at two couples that go out to dinner and the batterer, who isn't obviously striking the victim, is just putting them down. They're criticizing them. They're making fun of them. The likelihood of that other couple that may be a good resource to them ever wanting to spend time with them again is done and over with. Who wants to go out with a couple where the man in this situation is, you know, making fun of his wife and calling her names? That resource of that other couple, they may never talk to him again. And just that experience. So pulling away is pretty natural and common.
What would you recommend? So say someone wants to be more empathetic than these kinds of scenarios tend to cast them as being. How does that person respond to the situation you've just described?
The person who might be a resource?
Yeah.
Well, the most important thing is to decide if you're in or out. If you're going to be a resource, you've got to be a real resource. It's a long haul helping somebody who, as Scott was saying, you know, it takes a long while for some people to even be ready to change. So it's a real burdensome and potentially life-saving process, and the person who gets involved has to decide that they're in for the long haul. You can't these little short answers like just get out of it or just dump them or you know, you pack up and put his suitcase on the front porch. I mean, those kinds of brief phrases will never work.
Can we talk about that for a second? How can friends and loved ones help? Because it seems like forcefully urging someone to leave is a power struggle, much like, I mean, in some ways, like the relationship itself could be.
Well, if you believe in the notion of empowerment, what you do is to help people realize their strengths, their skills, their potential to do far better. It's not a bad idea to tell people who are victims how much you care about them and the reasons why you care about them as a method of getting them. You're contributing to them potentially liking themselves. If you're in a hurry to get somebody who's been battered to love themselves again, if you're in a hurry, this is not the kind of thing you want to do. It's not for people with thin skin who want to solve a problem for their friend real quick.
Swoop in and save the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You can stay at my house. It'll all be okay.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. I think the main thing that you can do is believe them and validate them. And keep in mind that they're not going to always disclose to you. So you know, talking to them about what Bruce was saying about, you know, that you don't deserve this. You deserve health, to be healthy and happy, and your children deserve to be healthy and happy and healthy. But believing and validating them each time is a huge part of the process to get them to trust you, to that they can disclose to you, and you're not gonna blame them for staying.
If you out there have questions about domestic violence or the complex realities behind a victim's decision to stay or go, call 816-235-2888 to speak with Scott Mason of the Rose Brooks Center and psychologist Bruce Lease, who's with us from KU Med. And I've asked both of you a little bit about what we from the outside often don't understand looking in. But are there things that people inside these relationships also misunderstand, that the victims and perpetrators are too close to see without certain distortions?
Yeah. My experience with people who have been victims of abuse is that they start out relatively passively, just assuming that their partner will be a good person. I mean, they don't go into the relationship, the marriage, or whatever it is, thinking, okay, I've got a violent partner, I'm going to brace myself for it. So they go in innocently thinking it will all be wonderful. It'll all be terrific. You know, those great feelings will last forever. So as people enter into a relationship, they expect the best. As their partner starts to abuse in subtle ways, words, like I said earlier, making fun of them, making faces at them, they may continue to be passive. The big mistake that a lot of victims make is they think reciprocating, returning the anger and lashing back out at their partner is a show of strength. And in fact, it just adds fuel to the fire. So, you know, if I were to get into a relationship with somebody who started to pick on me and I thought, well, the heck with this, I don't have to take that, and I start jabbing them back, a common trigger for domestic violence is somebody trying to defend themselves by saying, you know, I don't have to stay married to you. A lot of other people would love me a lot better than you. You can't control me. Those kinds of things, while they make sense to the victim, you know, I'm standing up for myself, can just take a really disturbed person and turn them into a violent, dangerous person.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. You know, and it's such the complexities of it, and we can't talk about the complexities enough of the emotions, because we all feel them. But absolutely, when you're in that relationship, it can be crazy making. You can begin to think that things are your fault because of what your abuser is saying to you, and then your abuser will the next day say, I can't live without you. You're the only one who understands me. You're the only one that is going to help me through whatever is going on. So it can be crazy making while you're in that relationship. And like Bruce said, relationships don't start out violent. But 9 times out of 10, when we talk to a woman or a victim about their relationship, there were those things, the extreme jealousy from the beginning. Things moved really fast. He told me he loved me very quickly. And a lot of – so that feels really good to us when we're in a relationship. And we often ask, why do women go from one abusive relationship to the next? And a lot of times it's because – they're disclosing to their new partner that they had this horrible relationship, and the message they get is, oh, I would never do that to you. And so they feed right into those insecurities and those past relationships, which is a really important part of when we work with women, to really educate them on what those red flags are and how to identify those and to move slowly through that relationship.
Scott, you used the term crazy making. A few things that we've started to talk about seem really important in regard to that term. Jealousy is often mistaken for, oh, he really loves me. You know, he really loves me or he wouldn't be jealous. And jealousy is a declaration of deep and profound insecurity. If somebody believes in themselves and the relationship, they simply don't feel jealous. But probably the most disturbing thing that I ever hear, and I'm going to guess that Scott hears this too, probably the most disturbing thing I hear is that, you know, I have to stay in it for the children, because what happens is innocent children are being destroyed by the devastation to their, let's just say here, mom, and it's doing so much destruction and devastation to the children who see that kind of violence towards a parent. And yet the parent believes, you know, they need a dad if it is a man, or, you know, I can't do this alone, or the kids couldn't handle another breakup. So, and the reason why I'm projecting here that it would be bothersome to you too, Scott, is these kids are innocent, and they really can't leave. They can't pack up and go to Rosebrooks by themselves at 6 years old.
Yeah, it's a painful thing to see. And, you know, and a lot of times when women come to us or when we're working with them and then their children start counseling and going to children's groups as well, you know, the women will tell us, oh, I've hidden the abuse from my child and they don't see it and I've really done a great job. And what we always find, of course, is that the children are impacted and we can help them start healing.
What this kind of brings up for me is that this question of who decides what's best in a situation, that the idea, something that comes up with the Rice scandal is Janae Rice telling people that they think they're acting in her best interest by bringing this out and they're not. But so who decides this question? Who decides what's best for victims, especially when children are involved?
I don't think Scott or I would claim to make decisions for anyone in the world. It's not really realistic. But I like to say, if he hits you, he doesn't love you. And now it's, you know, you're going to have to decide what you do with that notion. If he's hitting you, he doesn't love you. And they may claim he does, and I would never get into that argument. But the decision ultimately falls on the person who – the decision to batter is the batterer's decision, not anyone else's, and the decision to leave – ultimately has to be the decision of the victim.
Let's talk to Mary in Leavenworth. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. One of the things that I have found actually frustrating, listening to so much of the conversation, especially over these last number of weeks relating to the situations with the NFL, but just in general, is so often it seems like all of the responsibility gets placed on the victim. The responsibility of whether to stay or whether to not stay. And it seems like there is a distinct lack of accountability for the one that's doing the abusing. You know, where is it in their life? Where is it in their personal makeup? Where is it in their background that somewhere they just discovered this thought process that this kind of behavior is okay, that doing this to somebody else that you supposedly love is a reasonable and acceptable behavior.
Bruce, jump in here.
Yeah, I'm just kind of formulating this idea in my head, and I don't mind if anyone argues against it. Here's my thinking. I don't know that it's actual blame that's taking place towards the woman. I think that because none of us has a lot of compassion for the batterer, that it's hard to even keep that person in mind except to be angry at him. So, you know, my initial thought, of course, is, you know, Ray Rice ought to be locked up or whatever would work to keep him from harming somebody else. So I'm done with thinking about him at this point. You know, that's the end of it. I don't have a lot of hope for him. Now, that may be badly maybe I'm not right thinking that, but that's the first thing that pops into my head. He's not my patient. I can't and I won't be helping him. But when I think about the victim, it's not so much blame. It's more of this painful compassion that I have to deal with. It's more like it really hurts. So I cry out in pain, leave him. You know, what are you doing? Why don't you dump him? What's wrong with you? That's my automatic reaction, not because I'm blaming her, but because it's painful to watch somebody suffer who clearly is suffering. So I don't believe I've ever blamed a victim, but I sure have had a strong reaction of wanting to save them, yank them out of the situation, et cetera. And I feel like if I didn't have that reflex, I wouldn't be human.
So you're thinking that that comes out of greater concern for the victim, translating into greater interest in what
sympathy.
The victim is going to do now.
Yeah, just sympathy.
What do you think, Scott?
And I really appreciate you asking that question. I think part of victim blaming is always not asking the question, why does he abuse her? So I appreciate your question very much. And I think – and I completely understand where Bruce is coming from. But I really do think that when we hear about these cases that are so public, we really do need to shift our conversation to why does he abuse? Why did he do that? Because if we don't talk about that more, there's not going to be enough education about why he is abusing her. When we think about her relationship and their relationship together, it is painful to see her in that relationship because of the severe violence that we saw. But I agree with the caller. We really do need to shift that conversation.
Central Standard is going to take a quick break. We can still get you in on the discussion when we return. 816-235-2888. That number again, 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and just as a reminder, we're talking about difficult subject matter today that might serve as a trigger for some of our listeners. Today's topic is domestic violence. Our guests are psychologist Bruce Leese and Scott Mason of the Rose Brooks Center. Hello again, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello, Gina.
We have a caller who just called in. She couldn't stay on the line, but she had a question for us, which is, if it can take a long time to support someone through abuse, how do I know the difference between being helpful or being an enabler?
That's a good question. I think it goes back to what we've talked about back and forth today, is that it takes time. You can never think of it this way. The victim is already in an abusive relationship, a controlled relationship. So telling them to leave or insisting that they leave is exactly what they're experiencing in their abusive relationship already. So taking control and getting them to leave is more than likely going to stop them from being honest with you. I know it can be a fine line, but if you're consistent and just listen to them and trust them and validate them and talk them through that, I think it's an important part of the victim's healing too.
Does the bystander have an emotional set of circumstances to take into consideration as well? I mean, is there a point when a person watching this happen has to protect him or herself from what they're witnessing and can't control?
Absolutely. You know, and it's something that we have to work with too, because more than likely when a victim does leave the abusive relationship, they will go back. Statistically, approximately about 7 times they'll go back to that relationship. So it's difficult to support somebody through that process, and you can become jaded very quickly if you're not educated on what the dynamics are.
Let's talk to John in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, John.
Hello.
What can you share with us today?
I think you guys are focusing on the wrong entity. I sympathize with people being abused. But there's also it's also reversed in the situations. Women do things to control marriages, relationships. I've had my spouse call the police on me, lie on me, and say that I tell the police that I hit her in the face, so the police would come and arrest me because I would give her a certain amount of money out of my bank account. So we really don't know the whole picture between what happened between Rice and his girl, because we don't know what happened before he hit her.
All right. Thanks, John. So I guess John is saying that there could be layers of control and layers of manipulation, more even than the onlooker who's trying to be helpful always knows about.
Gina, I can't imagine how you could have come up with a better response to that. I mean, yeah, this. I think it's safe to say it's so complex. We never know all the details, and layers is good imagery.
I wonder, this does bring up the question of the role of law enforcement in dealing with these things. That's always an after-the-fact thing. Law enforcement can't prevent the abuse from taking place in the first place.
I really want to ask Scott a question I know you have the answer to. What is the impact of calling the police? I always heard that it decreases lethality, that ultimately, but I don't know if that's true, that the more you use police, the more you turn to police, the less likely it is that you will die at the hands of a batterer.
You know, and it's really important to, that is one of the reasons why we educate our law enforcement. We do as much work as possible educating them on the dynamics of abuse. So because many of them show up to the same house multiple times. But yes, especially with the Lethality Assessment Project, it does decrease the likelihood that a victim is going to be killed at the hands of the abuser. Because statistically, victims are not availed to domestic violence services. They know they exist. They don't know how to get to them. So this is one way to get it to them. And basically what happens is they will separate and do their interviewing. And if they assess that a woman is at a high lethality rate, they will actually call Rosebrooks right then and have them speak to a hotline right there with the victim. Now, 9 times out of 10, that she may not come in right away, or she may not want to speak about what just happened, but at least it avails them to the services that are available. So law enforcement plays a huge role in preventing. And what we're hoping and finding is that that the lethality assessment does act, it is starting to be preventative, because they're asking the right questions and they're telling these women that there are services out there.
And before we let this subject get away, I know we've touched on it briefly, but this idea, the image in people's heads that perpetrator is male and victim is female, can we unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah. And, you know, and I appreciate John calling in. I have worked with many men through the years, especially in the hospitals, that have disclosed that they're being abused by their female partner. And it often looks different. It's not always physical. And a lot of times it is emotional and financial and things like that John had mentioned. It is hard to uncover that. I do believe it happens at a higher rate than what we suspect. It's just highly underreported. But we really try to get away from using the he, we really try to be inclusive of that. And also because of the same sex abuse that happens.
Let's turn to Andrew in Kansas City. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I just had a question that, you know, it seems to me that a lot of what makes domestic violence possible is the way that especially men talk and think about relationships. And I just was interested to know your thoughts on what we can do as men to change the conversation in our lives to help prevent domestic violence, to change the way we think about relationships about women, and moreover, how men should approach other men in their lives who we might suspect might be an abuser. How do we initiate that conversation?
What a wonderful question.
It is. What an important question. We definitely need male advocates and male ambassadors against violence against women. And, you know, and I always tell people that because the underlying jokes that happen when we're in shared company or we're with other men, it is so easy for it to go sexist and against women and we hear it all the time in our own families and our own friends. You have to be a voice. You have to speak up. And I tell people to be a downer at a party in a minute if you hear those kinds of conversations happening. It is such an important role, no matter how much you think it is not or how much we want to minimize it. It is such an important part of our voice to stand up for that.
You mentioned jokes, and that's an interesting one because it is hard when someone is when the sort of expected social response is laughter. But the basis of a joke is that there's some shared assumption that
Correct.
That we both get it and that's why we're laughing. And if you don't share that assumption, that is a really uncomfortable moment.
Absolutely. You know, I can tell you a personal story right after right after the Ray Rice happened. I was at the gym and I heard a gentleman. They showed the footage on the TV and I heard a gentleman say, he laughed and said, boy, she walked right into that one talking about the punch. And I immediately knew that he had an audience. There was a room full of people working out. And I walked over to him and loudly just said, well, I actually did not do my job. I actually told him he was stupid for saying that. I could have used that opportunity to be a little bit more, to provide a little bit more education. But he actually immediately apologized and said, I was trying to be funny. And I said, well, I didn't want you or anybody else in here to think that I thought that was funny. And, you know, and those are the types of things that you're right. It was he said something that he thought everyone else would share in the humor, and it's important to stand up and say that that's not the same view that I share. And hopefully that will plant a seed for him as well.
Bruce, what kind of wisdom do you have to share with people? Just if there was one way of distilling how to think about this subject, one nugget of wisdom.
I would say that anger, hostility, and violence never, ever solve problems better than logic and rationality and empathy and all those things. If you can solve a problem with anger, you can solve it even better without anger.
Oh, thank you, Bruce. That's all the time we have for today's conversation. Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center, we always value your insights. I'm looking forward to having you back in the studio again next month.
Thank you.
And Scott Mason, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning. Best of luck to you and your work.
Thank you very much.
Scott Mason has been with us from the Rose Brooks Center. Tomorrow, in conjunction with a food waste documentary by Harvest Public Media, Central Standard hosts a conversation about alternative approaches to using, rather than wasting, food resources. Are you going to eat that? Tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. To listen back to today's show or any past conversations, go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.